Access to Democracy is made possible by donations from the following organizations. Thomson Reuters, a global company with expertise and insight to unravel complex situations in the areas of law, tax, compliance, government, and media. Their worldwide network of journalists and editors keep customers up to speed on relevant global events. Crutchfield Dermatology, a full-service treatment center and medispa in Eagan. Their goal is to help you look good and feel great with beautiful skin. With service built around courtesy, dignity, and respect, Mayo-trained Dr. Charles Crutchfield personally treats each patient and is acknowledged as one of the nation's best physicians. TrueStone Financial, with locations in Minnesota and Wisconsin, has proudly served its members since 1939. TrueStone engages, educates, and supports its members to ensure they have the tools to empower their financial well-being. TrueStone Financial, your neighborhood credit union. Learn more at TrueStone.org. Edina Eye Physicians and Surgeons, a division of Twin Cities Eye Consultants, has proudly served the Twin Cities for more than 55 years now in 7 convenient locations. Using the most advanced technology combined with human touch, Edina Eye offers comprehensive services and dedicated specialists committed to excellence with innovative procedures and expertise for the most advanced eye care.
Welcome to this episode of Access to Democracy. I'm your host today, Steve Francisco. It's my pleasure to welcome back to our show today a return visitor, you might say a frequent visitor, Professor Richard Painter from the University of Minnesota Law School and a candidate for the U.S. Congress from the 1st Congressional District in Minnesota is our guest today. He's been previously interviewed by my co-host, Alan Miller. It's my pleasure to welcome you back. Welcome back, Professor Painter.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us why are you running for Congress in the 1st District?
I'm running for Congress because I believe the people of the 1st Congressional District deserve someone who's going to represent all of the people of the district, not just the top 1%, not the special interests. That have been having an exorbitant influence on the current Congress. We need someone who's going to represent ordinary people, someone who's going to focus on the economic issues that people are worried about, inflation, price fixing, the slowing down of the rural economy across America, the need to generate clean energy through wind and solar power, which can actually help revive the rural economy. There's a lot we can do in Congress, but Congress isn't doing it because Congress is in the back pocket of the special interests, whether it's the big oil companies or the food companies or whoever who's ripping off the American people. So I'm there offering my services to the people. The 1st Congressional District is their representative in Congress for the completion of Representative Hagedorn's term in the special election and then for the next 2 years in the general election.
Let's talk for a moment about the geography of the 1st Congressional District. Under reapportionment, I don't think the boundary lines have changed very much. It's a large geographic district extending pretty much from the border with South Dakota all the way over to the eastern border with Wisconsin, taking in almost all of southern Minnesota, including cities such as Mankato, Rochester, Austin, Albert Lea, Worthington. Some people have noted that you don't currently live in the 1st Congressional District. Your home is in Mendota Heights. You've said that if you win this race, you plan to move into the 1st District of Faribault. Do you think this will create any difficulty for you among Democrats that you are asking to nominate you or among voters should you win the nomination?
It shouldn't. It's a large district, as you said, a very diverse district, ranging all the way from the areas in the east of the state and particularly Rochester, which is a major healthcare center with a with a Mayo Clinic as a major employer, all the way out to the west. And I will note that Jeremy Munson, the lead candidate for the Republican Party, has said that much of this congressional district actually ought to be relocated to South Dakota, in which case I would urge him to file for election in South Dakota, since he wants to represent South Dakota. But I'm here to represent Minnesota, the southern part of Minnesota, the 1st Congressional District, and moving down to Faribault, I'll be able to reach people in the district. I could do as good a job representing people in the district as anybody else from Faribault. So that's not going to be an issue.
And we should note too, of course, it's not a legal requirement that you have to live in the district that you represent, but really as a matter of practical politics, it's probably beneficial, wouldn't you agree?
Well, absolutely. If a member of Congress is representing a district, when that member comes home to their home state, they should be coming back to the district to talk to people, hopefully not just to the rich campaign contributors, who most members of Congress spend an inordinate amount of time talking with, but ordinary people throughout the district. And that's awfully hard if you live, for example, in St. Louis Park, as Representative Hagedorn did while he tried to represent the first congressional district. I would want to live in the district and talk to people in the district when I'm back in Minnesota.
Now, we should tell people who may not be very familiar with you, you were a Republican for many years. You served in the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, from 2005 to 2007. You were the chief ethics lawyer for that administration. You only became a Democrat in 2018. Why did you leave the Republican Party to become a Democrat? And what does being a Democrat mean to you?
Well, I would borrow Ronald Reagan's famous line about the Democratic Party, although I don't think it was very accurate when he said it about the Democratic Party, that the party left me. I didn't leave the party. The Republican Party has moved steadily to the right over several decades. We think about the news this week about potential reversal of Roe versus Wade. That was a 7-2 decision of the
United States. We're going to be talking about that too.
Yes. Two Minnesota Republicans on that court. One, Justice Blackmun, authored the opinion. The other, Chief Justice Berger, was in the majority. The idea that the Republican Party wouldn't stand up for women's right to choose at that point was viewed as ludicrous. Of course, Ronald Reagan started a trend in the other direction with respect to abortion, a lot of social issues. And we've had other problems of the Republican Party moving steadily to the right, increasingly in the back pocket of big business and special interests. And that was all before Donald Trump. What I wanted to do was hold down the moderate, some would say progressive wing of the Republican Party, because I think it's healthy for society to have two well-functioning political parties with a diversity of opinion in each. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump made it very clear that different opinions are not to be tolerated. And I made it very clear to the Republican Party that I'm going out the door.
Professor Painter, as you referenced the big news, which has really exploded as a political bombshell, if you will, was the story reported by Politico that they obtained a draft opinion by Associate Justice Samuel Alito indicating that the Supreme Court may, in fact, reverse Roe versus Wade, which has been settled law in the United States for nearly 50 years. They would leave it to the states to decide the future of abortion rights. And let's talk a little bit more about that, because when I was in law school, what I learned was that when the court granted constitutional rights and found that a person had an individual constitutional right, that's not something that we submit to voters and to popular majorities to overturn. What is your reaction? A little more detail about your reaction to this decision. And would you favor efforts in the Congress if you were elected to effectively nullify such a decision overturning Roe v. Wade?
First, constitutional rights that are set forth in the Roe versus Wade opinion that's 49 years old should be codified by the United States Congress. And I've urged that that be done now. And if that isn't done now, that's going to be a top priority for me when I arrive in the Congress in late August or September after winning the special election this next August. That's absolutely critical that Congress codify the constitutional rights in Roe versus Wade for the entire United States and the territories. This shouldn't be left up to individual states. A woman has the right to decide whether or not to have a child. The Roe versus Wade opinion was a correct opinion. It was a 7-2 decision of a majority Republican Supreme Court. And now, that being said, this shouldn't have been a bombshell at all this week, because the fact of the matter is we've known that this was going to happen as Donald Trump picked up three justices of the court And the Republicans successfully prevented President Obama from appointing Merrick Garland as his third appointment, even though President Obama served two terms and was reelected, right, unlike Donald Trump, who was not and went out the door in insurrection. So we've now got a situation which is quite obvious that the Supreme Court is going to be very hostile to Roe versus Wade. Now, there are various ways they could go. They could have upheld the Mississippi law, which I believe was a 15-week ban without disturbing Roe versus Wade, which was a first trimester limit, saying you cannot strike down abortion. You cannot prohibit abortions during the first trimester. There are a number of different routes that could go. The Alito opinion is just a draft. It's an extreme version. I'm not convinced that he really had five justices agreeing to that, certainly not definitively. We don't know where the leak came from. My suspicions are that someone leaked it in order to try to pressure the justices who tentatively agreed to it to just sign on and overturn Roe. It could have been leaked out of the other side. I don't know.
Isn't it interesting, too, that the reaction to this leaking of the story, that Republicans seem to be outraged, if you will, by the leak, whereas on the Democratic side, the outrage is about the impact of overturning Roe versus Wade itself. That's
I'm not happy about either one. I wonder about these Republicans, though, who are complaining about the leak. We'll find out who is responsible for the leak, but you always think about those stories of the man who calls 911 and says, my wife, somebody hurt my wife. Who's the first person they suspect? So sometimes the people crying the loudest about it may know something about who leaked. This leak, I think, only benefits the people trying to force through that Alito opinion as the opinion of the court. And remember, that opinion is completely unnecessary, even if they want to uphold the Mississippi law. So I don't like the leak, but I got to say, we saw this going on with this court as soon as Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed to replace Justice Ginsburg, who died literally 2 months before the election. And Mitch McConnell, who was on record saying that President Obama should not be able to appoint a justice in his last year in office.
Right.
Mitch McConnell just says, well, we got a different set of rules here. Well, I've got something to tell people. I've looked at the Constitution. I don't see the number 9 in there. And, if they want to keep horsing around at Supreme Court politicizing things and taking away constitutional rights that have been there for 49 years, we're going to have to think about what the intent of the framers was. And the intent of the framers was not that there have to be 9 justices. They would have put the number 9 in there if they wanted it that way. Well, the intent of the framers was that the Congress, including the House, and that's why this is critical to this race, the House and the Senate can, by statute, set the number of justices. And the court, for whatever reason, is not reflective of the American people and the values of the American people, some adjustments can be made.
I want to ask you about the implications of the decision. In fact, if it does, in fact, become the decision, we're going to find out the end of next month whether or not Roe versus Wade has, in fact, been reversed. It certainly looks, every indication is that it will be. What are the implications of this if there is no constitutional right to privacy? And that's what the position is of those who are trying to nullify Roe. If there is no constitutional right to privacy, what does that mean for the future of things such as same-sex marriage, for contraceptives, for other things that those opinions were prefaced on an implicit right to privacy?
Well, certainly the contraception case, Griswold versus Connecticut, would fall if there were a finding there is no constitutional right to privacy. The same-sex marriage case, I think, could be more firmly grounded in the 14th Amendment, equal protection. Of course, abortion also should be protected as a constitutional right under the equal protection clause and the rights guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. Even though that's not the way Roe versus Wade cast the decision. But bottom line is, we're going to have to codify some of these rights on a national level through Congress. We need a Congress that's going to be aggressive about this and get it done. They should be doing it before I even show up if I win this election. It should be done right now. We should have seen the handwriting on the wall a long time ago once President Trump was able to replace Justice Ginsburg with Justice Barrett. So we didn't enact those laws, and then let this court know that if this keeps going on, this type of politicization of Supreme Court decisions, we're really going to have to think about the composition of the court.
I want to ask you, we have a lot to cover here. I want to ask you about the state of our democracy. It seems that our democracy itself is under assault. The January 6th insurrection, we have members of Congress openly peddling conspiracy theories about former President Trump's defeat in 2020, the rise of white nationalism and outright racism in our politics. We also see broad assaults on voting rights in many state legislatures and gerrymandering minority districts to dilute their representation. So how can we fend democracy here at home and abroad when too many of our own politicians are attacking the very foundations of our democracy?
Well, first, the House and the Senate do need to pass voting rights legislation. Bills have been proposed in the bills can get through the House, but they can't get through the Senate. We're going to have to change that. We need voting rights legislation. The state should not be able to decide who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote, and then craft the voting registration or voting laws in a way that discriminate against certain racial minorities and others who are perceived not to support the political party in power. That's not how democracy works. So we need some clear rules. The 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution provides for equal voting rights. Instructs the Congress and says Congress shall enforce the 15th Amendment. They didn't get around it to the 1960s with the Voting Rights Act. Now that's getting watered down. It's time to get back to work, get a bill through that protects voting rights. Voting rights are absolutely essential. And that also means cracking down on gerrymandering. Minnesota, fortunately, doesn't have too much of it. But you go look at a place like Pennsylvania, and it really looked, those maps look like modern art that I can't understand. And we know what's going on.
Look at a state like North Carolina, I believe, where the federal court stepped in and said, what you drew here for a map is unconstitutional. We need our judges, our federal courts, to be protecting this right. You're seeking to represent one of the most agricultural congressional districts in America, the first congressional district of Minnesota. So what do you see as the biggest issue or problem facing our farmers today?
Well, the problems facing our farmers are economic and climate. We'll start with the economic problems. We see more and more corporatization of farming, bigger and bigger farms owned by large corporations, squeezing out the family farms, squeezing out even medium-sized corporate farms. There is monopoly power with respect to the inputs that the farmers need. They buy fertilizer and supplies, they buy a John Deere tractor, and then you want to get the tractor repaired, and John Deere or whoever their repair representatives are is ripping them off. There's serious problems with respect to monopoly power that farmers have to deal with when they buy their inputs, and then also when they sell their produce, where they're selling grain to the big cereal companies or to Cargill or in the exchanges, or whether they're selling pork to the big pork manufacturers. There are antitrust suits pending against the pork manufacturers right here in the southern, in the district of Minnesota, alleging that the four or five major pork manufacturers have been fixing prices for the consumers. So the prices are going sky high, but the hog farmer's not getting any of that. That's all going to the corporate intermediaries so they can pay their CEOs enormous salaries. Two of the companies have settled that case in Minnesota, Smithfield Foods for, I think, 50-something million dollars. They're owned by the Chinese. So the point is, the hog farmer, the wheat farmer, everybody's just getting squeezed. Who's in agriculture, those consumers are getting squeezed because the corporate monopolists are running away with the lion's share of the profits. Second, climate change. You know, climate change is causing flooding and drought, not just in southern Minnesota, throughout America. Farmers on the front line of climate change and dealing with climate change. And that's why I've said on the campaign trail, I think a farmer who votes for climate change denier is like a chicken who's voting for Colonel Sanders. You know, it makes no sense. And we need someone in Congress who's going to recognize that problem and deal with it and get emergency relief to farmers.
I want to delve a little deeper into what you said just a moment ago about the price fixing. You posted on your website the other day that your campaign website, you noted that Hormel, which is based, of course, in Austin, Minnesota, in the first district, profits increased on their turkey sales by 122% in a single year. Do you believe that Hormel and these other companies are still engaged in fixing prices?
Well, I don't know all the facts. All I know is that the plaintiffs in these cases, one pending in Chicago, one in Minneapolis, one I saw in Connecticut, these are all in federal court, that the plaintiffs believe that they are. The plaintiffs are range from food companies like Subway sandwiches, which buys meat from these companies, to various wholesale distributors. And these cases have been going along for quite a while, and they allege a price fixing scheme going all the way back to 2009. All I know is that they are sky high profits at Hormel. The stock is fabulous. I mean, if you've been able to afford to buy some Hormel stock, and you live in the first congressional district, that's great. So I'm thrilled to hear about profit sharing plans and everything. The problem is the average consumer isn't sharing in the profits from the stock, because the average consumer doesn't have any money left over after a trip to the grocery store. So, you know, I think that this is a phenomenon. It's not just meatpacking. It's not just Hormel. It's that, you know, we see it in oil. Price of oil goes up and down. Price of gas just going up. The White House has a really good chart on that. Monopoly power. You have monopoly power in any industry, and then a supply chain interruption, and you can bet that monopoly power can be used to extract enormous profits. It's what the oil companies did back in 1973 with the oil embargo.
Let's talk a little bit further about climate change. I take it you were supportive of the Biden administration returning the United States to the Paris Climate Accord, trying to set targets for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. What should Congress be doing in addition to that to support climate change? What types of legislation would you support? For example, do you continue to support a carbon tax, credits for solar and wind developments, things such as this?
Well, I certainly support the targets of the Paris Accord, but you know the targets are no good unless you got a plan for meeting them. And my focus has been mostly on the production side, that we need to produce not just small amounts, but large amounts of wind energy and solar energy in this country, and we can do it. And we can put up wind turbines throughout rural America. We can put money in the pocket of the farmer. We can create jobs hooking those wind turbines up to the electric grid. The same with solar power in many parts of our country. We can do this. And it's going to be win-win for everyone, particularly for rural areas where it's going to be very easy to generate this electricity and then transmit it back to the cities. I call it reverse rural electrification. We talked about, you know, in the 1920s, generating electricity in the cities and taking it out to the farms. We're going to do it the other way around. And we're going to make money in the first congressional district. I want Congress, though, to step in with not just small subsidies, but with very substantial infrastructure spending on wind and solar power throughout America. We need to do this quickly. It's a matter of great concern now. It's a national security concern when we see that the Saudis or the Russians are sitting on a lot of the oil supply and jerking everybody around. We can't put up with that.
Right. And also, you mentioned the wind turbines. How about building those wind turbines in the United States? I know that I think it was Netherlands and some other countries have really invested in a huge way in producing those types of wind turbines. I just passed through the Netherlands recently on a trip to Europe, and I saw a lot of the wind turbines. Anybody who's ever been in southern Minnesota knows there's a lot of wide open space there and a lot of wind generated across the prairie. So not only farmers living down there using wind turbines to generate power, but how about producing the wind turbines in the first CD and other places in America?
Absolutely, we can do that. It'd be a lot cheaper and more efficient to produce the wind turbines here and then to install them. And of course, we've got to hook them up to the grid. So there's a lot of work to be done. We're going to be creating a lot of jobs. This is about economic growth. This is a pro-growth platform, but this is about clean energy and getting away from the fossil fuels. This isn't going to hurt jobs, it's going to create jobs. And that needs to be the message that gets through in the United States Congress. And we're going to be pushing that hard. So this isn't just, you know, we're going to save energy and tell people not to use so much. No, we are going to produce energy. We're going to do it right here in the first congressional district. And then we can sell them energy to Minneapolis and they can pay us for it.
Mm-hmm. The first district, as you well know, contains many small towns that have lost population as older people have passed on. Younger people leave for the Twin Cities for economic opportunities, better jobs. What should be done to revitalize rural America and our small towns? Because it seems we can't really have a healthy statewide economy in Minnesota if we don't have a healthy rural economy. So what can we do? What can Congress do to revitalize rural America, aside from what we've already discussed?
Well, yes, in addition to energy production, which I believe is going to be key to revitalizing rural America, wind energy and solar energy production. The other things we can do to bring in businesses, what we need to do is have broadband internet be accessible and high-speed internet accessible to everyone, not just in the big cities. That's critically important to people bringing in new businesses. A lot of businesses can be conducted in all sorts of geographic locations these days because you're doing business over the computer. We're having this interview over Zoom. Physical presence is not necessary for many, many businesses, from financial services to consulting. There is an enormous amount you could do in southern Minnesota. We have beautiful parts of the state away from the congestion of the Twin Cities, where people would love to live if they could make some money. And there's a lot we can do. So broadband internet is a number one priority. We're not going to leave it to Comcast. Comcast is just there to hoover people's wallets. That's all they're interested in. We can't have a private company deciding who gets access to internet, who doesn't. This should be a national priority.
As you noted at the outset of this interview today, Richard, the first congressional district is home to Rochester and the world famous Mayo Clinic. Many smaller cities and towns are seeing local hospitals downsize and closing. The pandemic has hit some of these rural areas particularly hard. What can be done to ensure that people have access to affordable quality care? And you've previously been on the record supporting a single payer approach to providing health care. Do you still, and what can be done to make sure that people have access to the health care they need?
Well, I wouldn't want to take away people's insurance they already have, but I would say that a single payer system is a heck of a lot more efficient than having the insurance companies and their CEOs take a lot of money out of people's pocket when they aren't really producing anything. I like to see the money go to doctors and nurses and healthcare providers. We also need to support rural hospitals, support telemedicine, so doctors can talk to other doctors, perhaps over at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and show them images. There's a lot we can do with high technology, the types of technology we have these days, to support medicine in rural America. Once again, Congress needs to help. Rural America is being left behind because the Republican Party has pretended to represent them and has done absolutely nothing for people who live in rural America.
On education, you've said previously that you support federal funding for low-cost or free public higher education, including trade schools. What's the return on that type of investment as you see it?
Well, we had free college at public universities, or very low tuition public universities throughout the United States all the way through the 1970s. So that's an era where we have regressed. And we have enormous amounts of money being spent on higher education in the United States. A lot of money going to ultra wealthy private universities.
Richard, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. It looks like we're just about out of time. We're going to have you back on to continue this. I apologize, but the clock is our master. Thank you. Richard Painter, candidate for the DFL endorsement for Congress in the 1st Congressional District. Thank you for appearing on Access to Democracy.
Thank you very much for having me.